Morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. I was told I was supposed to say hello world as well, because there's actually live streaming to other locations and real-time translations. It's Sunday morning, so happy everyone came out. So I first discovered blockchain back in 2014 when I was working for Tim Draper back in the Silicon Valley. That was the time Ethereum wasn't invented yet. There was a lot of questions around what's the use case for Bitcoin. So I went through this process. I think you are on different places in understanding blockchain. I went through the process. So I want to make this a very casual conversation where you can ask any questions you want. A few brief words about PTS. I won't actually do the whole presentations because we will be covering different part of this as we talk. But it is a secure multi-party computation framework for data collaboration protocol. What does that mean? So let's break it down for a bit. It's a secure security, meaning privacy preservations, and on different steps of the data collaboration processes, which incorporated some of the encryption techniques that is highly relevant to blockchain amongst other best practices in the data industries. And then the second word is multi-party, right? Multi-party meaning you actually allow different data owners to collaborate together without exposing their raw data for aggregational computational tasks. So basically, right now, most of the computations in the big data world still happens within organizations. However, let's use our use case, for example, like credit scoring for people in emerging countries such as in China. You actually want to use like 30 to 50 different types of variables, because most people don't have the direct lending history such as FICO or Vanguard actually requires. People just simply haven't taken out of loans, and you want to use alternative variables related to their education, for example, employment, e-commerce, shopping behaviors, etc., as examples. And those data don't live in the same place, right? So you actually want to have data owners from a very wide range, from individuals to internet companies to financial institutions, to be able to collaborate beyond the borders of their organizations to actually perform better machine learning to provide accurate credit scorings for those people who want to take out the loans. Instead of right now in the ground, either you cannot have access to capital, or they charge you like 600%, because as long as 1 out of 10 people pay back, they are fine, and there's a huge focus on the collection rather than having a good risk pricing. So computation, so the last word is computation, is basically data analysis. So this is the concept of secure multi-party computations. And it has been introduced back in 1986 by Turing Award winner Andrew Yao. But it has had problems in computational complexity before the blockchain-based architecture was designed. So it's now possible with good design to implement this idea on blockchain. So that's kind of a brief introduction for what Points does, why this matters. And there are additional use cases that goes beyond fintech as well, which we can explore in a little bit. So that's a quick overview, and I will have my co-pilot today join me as well, and I will let him pronounce his name by himself.
Yeah. So Gianni was not correct. Janer is how you pronounce my name, but it's okay. It's close enough. That's closer than most people get. So we'll start off, I think, by first saying that if you want to ask questions beside the Slido later, I'll take questions. If in the end questions arise and you couldn't put them onto the Slido, I will of course take you, and we'll get as many questions in as possible, basically, and make this as interactive as possible. I first wanted to ask who of you actually knows a bit about blockchain, or where your level is, basically. Have you just heard of it and know approximately what it is, or are there some experts here, let's say? No experts, or one? Okay, so then we'll start the talk a little bit slowly, maybe asking Sarah, you were in the accelerator, right? of the Draper Accelerator?
Yeah, I worked there as one of the early members.
Yeah, and Draper is one of the biggest personalities basically in the blockchain industry right now. How did you get into blockchain? Maybe just to get to know you. I mean, how did you take the step into your own company, basically getting the idea to start something yourself?
Yeah, so it's a very Silicon Valley-ish story, in fact. So I went to Harvard for graduate school. So I did MBA at Harvard Business School and Master in Public Policy at Kennedy School of Government. In one of the tracks HBS organized, we went to Silicon Valley, right? So of course, we went to Sand Hill Road. Then we visited DFJ, and Tim was the alumni of HBS back in the 80s. And when we were like walking out of the building, and he was like walking in, then we stopped him. And the track leader stopped him and said, "Hi, like we are visiting DFJ from HBS." Then Tim actually said, "All right, I made an introduction." And by the end of that conversation, he said, "I'm actually starting this new accelerator in Silicon Valley, but two out of three of my main staff, they were a lady and they got pregnant lately and they had to take maternity leave. So are there any one of you interested in coming and helping me out?" So then I was like, "Okay, me." Then we had a phone call later, and he was like, "Okay, come join us for the summer." I thought that was a great chance to check out Silicon Valley, and at the front seat. So I went to work for the accelerator as the growth hacker for the summer, and I stayed on did more work during the school time for a year plus. And that summer was 2014. So that was the time actually Tim bought all the Bitcoins that FBI confiscated from the Silk Road the crime investigation. So we had that press conference in our office with the New York Times about why did he spend $17 million to buy all those Bitcoins. Because everyone bid it below market price, and he bid it above the market price. So he actually bought all 10 slots of the auction, and everyone thought it was crazy. So from that, I got exposed to this, and because he was also the legendary investor who backed Tesla and Baidu and all that, I had a healthy interest into this thing from the first place. Because then, back then, only Mark Andreessen and Tim Draper were the like mainstream people who love Bitcoin. If you go to meetups, they will give you like paper wallet of free Bitcoins. But the topic was, so what's the use case of this besides money laundering and like drug dealing and all that? That was the big question. And we had at that time there was a YC company who was making like Bitcoin ATM machines, and they were like trying to find vendors in Shenzhen to help them out. So I helped them for a little bit. So Ethereum wasn't invented, the whole smart contract thing didn't exist and all that. The name of points, like dots get connected over time. Then I studied more about like public policy, because back in school a lot of discussion was about like how to make democracy work. There are accountability problems, disclosure problems, transparency issues, etc. So what's the improved version of institutional governance? And essentially, a lot of the blockchain-related projects are in one aspect exploring those governance issues and trying to reduce the arbitration costs and trying to implement some of the governance thinkings in code. So that it reduces those kind of complications. I came back to China, I work for Amazon, and then I came back to China, and I work for Xiaomi's ecosystem company Ninebot, and help them to build the robotics and AI division out, and build a whole developer network around that. And back last year, I thought about really like doing my own startup. I came across my second mentor, which is Professor Zhang Shoucheng, and also the founding chairman of DHVC, and one of the best-known scientists in the Chinese society. And he was like, sir, so if your favorite book is a lot of Republica type of political philosophy books, you knew this from early on, you did product, you built developer networks, why don't you actually think about doing something in blockchain as a startup? Then I was like hugely biased by my experience of going to the meetups. Everyone is talking about what's the use case of Bitcoin, right? So I was like, I'm not sure the technology is now ready to build something that's actually scalable and meaningful, production ready. And so I spent a few months to looking to the white papers and development in this space more closely. And I finally found a conviction. So it's ready to build a usable and a very useful thing, such as points. So because the promise of blockchain, a huge element is to bring alive the concept of value internet, meaning like you actually more fairly distribute values across the ecosystem participants. Instead of in the current internet arrangement, the ownership is different. Is not aligned with the participants in the ecosystem. So, so the biggest category for the so-called digital native asset is data. So that's why I think building a blockchain-based data collaboration protocol that distributes value fairly across participants is a good idea, especially in credit landscape here in China, like I explained. Only one out of three people have lending histories. So, but those people own their own data. So do other organizations who don't have a channel to effectively participate in such type of task and business yet. So I went out to assemble the required resources from data partnerships perspective, from team perspective, and draw out the architectural design. And that's how Points got started step by step. Yeah. The longer answer, but that was the history.
But very interesting, very comprehensive, but interesting answer. I have a direct question to that because you said that was that you'd started before Ethereum basically was there. You were working already in the accelerator and so on, mm-hmm. and later on moved to your own project. But my question is now: is your project built on a specific blockchain, or do you have a own blockchain that you build these things up on? Because most blockchains. You might have to know is they are really slow. So if you want to work on the blockchain, you can't really do much because there are, for Bitcoin, for example, 3 to 7 transactions per second, which is nothing. You can't do much with that. You can just send money with it and have to wait quite a long time until you know that the money has arrived. So I want to ask you whether you've built your own blockchain, you're using a specific blockchain. Yeah.
So I have a... interesting answer to this question, which will probably confuse you even more. So neither. we are a chain agnostic protocol, which can be based on different public chains. So we can support. So in the traditional or like the classic tech space, people probably now understand this concept of cloud agnostic. So you can build your softwares based on different cloud architectures. So we borrow that concept and want to build chain agnostic protocols because meaning actually we built a pretty thick service layers which includes a lot of the data handling techniques and also our own layer 2 scaling mechanisms, which solves the problem that you were mentioning earlier. The scalability is one big problem in blockchain right now. How can you actually process enough number of transactions each second to be usable in real scenarios, such as it's also crazy to take on China lending as the first use case because that's one of the most demanding one. Here on the ground, if you apply for loans on your phone, people actually expect to get the approval result within a second. So we thought if we can do this, we can do other things more easily. So that's why we had our own ways to improve throughput and reduce latencies on the service layers. So that we are not subject to the TPS transaction per second requirement specs of the current chains. If they have very high ones right now, most of the things in production, the chains, the highest is probably around 5,000-ish. So if it is higher, if they're higher, we take advantage of that, but we are not only using their mechanisms. We think that's the right thing to do, because all the chains will need such type of protocols to enable useful use cases. But there are already this many people trying to build out chains. So we want to work on the second layer problems. Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. A little bit of a confusing answer. I understand what she's saying, though. So basically, you're not interested in the lowest layer, which is basically the blockchain itself,
right,
as much as you are in the service that you're providing. So that's connected to it, but you don't have to have a direct connection. You are not in the blockchain itself, in the business of building the blockchain, right?
So it depends on definition. So we use the ledger part of blockchain, meaning like recording like what transaction has happened at what time between so and so of the public chain. We also use their smart contracts as a execution engine. But beyond that, all the service layers we do by ourselves. And that's different from the apps. Yeah. So because we don't feel it's necessary to reinvent the ledger and smart contract part of things. Yeah. But if that's helpful.
DApps, if you don't know what that is, that's basically decentralized applications built on the blockchain. That's a really, really big part of the blockchain. Maybe you can briefly explain what a DApp is, just for the listeners to know what it is.
Yeah, so essentially, DApps are just applications that are based on blockchains. Yeah,
okay.
So it's true. So it can look exactly the same for most of the user interfaces part, but the lower architecture is based on blockchain. Sometimes it requires, depending on what it is, sometimes it requires a managing your own private key in accessing the services in that decentralized application. So it uses a different key system from the user perspective. Otherwise, it's mostly the underlying architectural design and the flows behind that you may not experience as a user. However, it does change the how business runs, though. For example, in a decentralized browser, as an example. So a lot of the decentralized browser application is on the premise that, so right now Facebook is using all our data to do advertising, and they are the one collecting money. I got nothing from it. So some of the decentralized browser first allows you to do better permission management for what type of data is the browser collecting. Second, when they actually use your browsing behavior data to push you advertisements, they actually pay you for that. So, and these things are written into smart contracts. So you automatically get some payments for the attention and your information contribution to that. Although your browsing experience itself is pretty similar to a typical browser. And in a decentralized e-commerce shopping apps, for example, they may write rules that the merchants cannot, if there are certain type of pricing mechanisms, it's hard for the merchants to actually change in the background about how many units have been sold. Because I think some of you guys know here, like in some of the shopping festivals, like the merchants nowadays just change their sales volume to like 3x. And display it, or change the review system arbitrarily by themselves, because that's a centralized system. So some of the e-commerce, decentralized e-commerce shopping application, if they use smart contract in the reputation part of things, review part of things, then actually So it's much harder for the merchants to cheat on that part, for example. Yeah.
I'll do a small segue into data sharing, data privacy, maybe with a small anecdote. I'm from Germany myself, and there's an app basically emulating Tinder on the blockchain. So it's very successful because it's Tinder, basically. But you are controlling your data in a way that you can identify yourself more clearly. You can basically say this person is actually this person and not just a picture and a name. But there's one problem that comes with it, because blockchains can't be muted. You can't just stop what's going on the blockchain, because once you put something on the blockchain, it's forever there. Whereas in a database, you go inside the database and you just delete everything. But here you can't do that, because that's the safe part of the blockchain. The nice part of the blockchain is you can't just go and delete something. It's not a system like that. So this immutability also gives you problems, right? I want to ask you, how do you make sure that if a system is immutable, that someone can still maintain their right to be forgotten?
So I think this is one of the area mistakes can easily happen if the architectural design is done wrongly. Because a lot of people think blockchain is immutable as the main feature. A more precise interpretation for that is one that if you write data on chain, then unless you own 51% of the computational power, you won't be able to change it. So there are two parts. So one, is it necessary to put all the data on chain? The answer is no. So a lot of the raw data shouldn't be written onto blockchain from the first place. But that doesn't mean like blockchain cannot play a role in like identifying who has what through a search mechanism and brokering those collaborations and keeping some part of that record. For example, who participated in this collaboration and how much each should be paid on blockchain. So we are not we definitely don't think like you should put all the information on chain. Most of the data storage should be off chain, and for example, like the raw data should be owned in each person's individual devices or servers, and only aggregational computational tasks are done on those, and only the transaction TX ID will be recorded on chain. So if you are not understanding all the like words I'm saying, but one thing you should remember is blockchain doesn't mean writing all the data on chain, and in most cases you shouldn't write the raw data on chain. So in that sense, you can implement write for erasure. That's the new name for write to be forgotten according to the latest GDPR. So blockchain in some sense is actually have natural benefits to complying with GDPR. You know, because like, if we ask why is so that even Tencent cannot comply with GDPR with their current architecture, because they never recorded who had what data at what place, and that was the exactly the requirement for GDPR. You should know who owns what data and where it is, and who has used it, whether you have permission to do that. And that's blockchain is good at. So you can have the data generation ownership history is a natural fit with blockchain. It actually naturally records like who owns what and what's the time series for that. And then you can choose to be unplugged from the network. So basically, because there is permission system there, so you can send a denial for accessing your data, right? Essentially, right to be erasure is just sending, no matter who you are, I'm going to deny or giving you this piece of raw data. Although the network still knows that information exists, but no one can access it. So that's our implementation of right to be erasure. So that's why we advocate blockchain can be compatible with blockchain if it's well implemented. And that's why we think there needs to be a data protocol, because otherwise, if you design it that way, that all the raw data is recorded on chain from the first place, then is no longer possible.
Okay. Thank you for that answer. For those of you that don't know what GDPR stands for, it's General Data Protection Regulation. I think in China it might not have been too, not well known. Let's say it has not been mentioned too often, maybe. I just heard of it or got into it when I went back to Europe. I just came back a few days ago, and even if you go to the dentist now, you have to sign basically forms now that say that you know about everything that's going on. Nobody reads those, but you have to fill them in everywhere you go. So if we take this now, we have new regulations going on. I mean, we have seen the scandals, maybe not here, but in Europe and the Western world with Facebook, and many scandals just happening with Google and Facebook in general, let's say. How do you make people in those times still share their data? How do you make them willingly share their data without having to?
Yeah, so I think there are a few steps, right? First of all, it's about explaining this concept of SMPC, secure multi-party computation, and letting people know that. Also, I stopped using the word data sharing. I tried to stop using the word data sharing a while ago, because data sharing seems to indicate that we're just putting all the data into a huge database that we share. And that's not how SMPC operates. So your data is still in your own server or devices. Only a localized model and provide a update to the bigger model. So the raw data never leaves, and it requires your permissions. So first of all, is to making people know that now there's new technical paradigm that enables such kind of collaboration without exposing the raw data. And two is that how do you prove that's true? Because like we explained earlier, one of the issues is that the decentralized application may not look that different from the previous ones. Good and bad. Good thing is you don't need to adapt your user behavior as much. Bad thing is, how do I know you said you are not collecting my data? So that's why open source is such a big deal in this industry. So you put it up out there, and you provide pages where a average programmers can go and check if your code is actually running as you claimed. Then that introduces public scrutiny and also accountability. That's also why in this space of data collaboration, there are other high-flying projects who advocate a different method, which is using chips. So if you have read about Intel's SGX or Berkeley Professor Dongsum's work on Oasis Labs, so they are trying to solve the problem of scalability, meaning blockchain so slow versus the privacy preservation, by putting the some of the computational task into the chips to dislink the smart contract part from the bookkeeping part. So that's a very smart idea too. But when we compare the more our main approach is more software driven, right? So we build this whole thing, it's mostly software, and that one uses part of the chips and hardware. So we think software is always easier to be audited compared to hardware. So their way is saying that compared to SGX, the Berkeley chips is a open source chips, so you can make your own chips. And then all our software is often also open source. So in that way, the entire thing is transparent, and you know, like, I'm not doing any malware at all. I think it's a good approach, but still, it's harder for ordinary people to audit what exactly is running in those chips. Very few people will burn your own chips. So we think having the entire software-based solution where people can go to pages and check what code is exactly being run is a easier transparency method to ensure people know not only is a claim of SMPC, it is actually a SMPC.
Just a quick reminder, the Slido QR code is still up here. So if you have questions at any point, we'll come back to these questions later. Just don't forget that it's always in the background hovering there, so you always have an option and can just ask a question. I'm not taking questions right now, but later on we'll be taking questions. And